Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy week before everyone goes on vacation for at least a little while, hopefully, week.
Yeah, for those who celebrate, Merry Christmas. For those who don't, Merry Almost Camping World Bowl. And
belated Happy Hanukkah.
Belated Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa in advance. Happy Jim Boeheim might have an aneurysm week based on how this offense is playing.
Yeah.
We'll start there because we're going to move on to football. For those planning ahead, we're starting with a little bit of basketball, and then we're going to move on to signing day as well as the Camping World Bowl. We won't be recording an episode during the week of Christmas just because of the days of the week and everything. It just became too complicated. So we're just doing this instead. Please bear with us. Dan, your thoughts after the most frustrating loss to date for Syracuse?
Not great. I think we knew ODU was pretty good. I saw that line like creeping up towards Syracuse, and I actually almost thought about betting against Syracuse just because I thought that ODU was not getting enough credit. That being said, Syracuse should not be losing to ODU at home ever.
Right.
It was a very disappointing loss. I think it really outlined the problems that we kind of knew this team already had. Obviously, like, we had some decent recent wins, but the issues have not gone away. Tyus is the only one who is consistently having strong performances now, and even he, you know, he was only 5-for-24. He got to the line a bunch, which was good. Frank, still not 100%, still struggling. I mean, he's not really like looking for his shot at all, but
did hit two threes, knocked
down a lot. He did hit two threes, which is nice. O'Shea Brissett had a really quiet game again. He's, I think, been very concerning. I think his play might be the single most concerning part of the season so far. And you can take that on the bright side because, like, we know what he can do. We know the kind of player he can be. So, like, hopefully he rebounds. But, yeah, he just hasn't been the same guy. I mean, I think it's not that controversial to say he was better last season to this point. Right. The center position is a major issue. I kind of think we might need to just start rolling with Dolezal there, even if you don't want to start him. I think, like, based on – and without looking at, like roster plus minus or anything.
He's more effective.
I don't have access to that. I kind of feel like we just might need to roll small because he's been the most effective fifth player on the team for the most part. And obviously you're going to need Chukwu and Sidibe for their fouls and for some time, but – like, I do think the team works the best when Dolezal is involved and when he's playing, and your other four best players are the four perimeter guys. So it wouldn't shock me. I mean, I think Boeheim will make that move if he needs to. I think he's going to be a little reluctant to do it because he does have a 7'2" center who has shown at times over the last couple years that he can be effective, but he just has not been effective this season.
Yeah, he had like a one-game like stretch where I think he had like 8 points or so earlier in the year, but like you look at the line in this ODU game, Chukwu and Sidibe combined for 32 minutes. They were 0-for-1 from the floor. They were 0-for-2 from the free throw line. They had a total of 7 boards. I've got 2 blocks, a turnover, and 4 personal fouls. Dolezal, 1-for-2 field goals. 6 boards, 2 assists, 1 steal, 1 foul. I think it's very clear based on the numbers who the more effective player is.
Yeah, and obviously that's not like even a great game from Marek. And he, even if he doesn't play anymore, like any more than he is now, he needs to be more assertive, I think. He's a very good passer. He's shown a little bit of a jump shot. I think he's a very cerebral player. He does really good things on defense. Obviously that Georgetown charge that he took was huge. So like either way, I think we need to see more. We need to see him get more himself, more involved. But even when he's not like looking for his shot or anything, he is still, I think, the best option of the five for at least the majority of minutes. I'm not saying he needs to play 40 minutes there, but I do think we need to see him at least playing like 25 to 30 minutes a game in the middle, because I just think that's the best lineup we can roll out there right now. And hopefully Sidibe and Chukwu can start to eat into that and prove that they deserve those minutes, because right now they are just holes on at the five. And I hate to say that because I do think we've seen really good things from them in the past. Chukwu had some really nice games in the NCAA tournament run last year. Sidibe obviously had that huge pit game.
We know they can play on offense.
We know they can play. Yeah, and neither one's ever going to be like a number one option, but you know they're can be effective like screen and roll players, and they can do some things in general, and this is not happening right now. So We're getting to the point where we need to like start winning all these games that we need to win. Like, we're I'm not like going to freak out and say this team's definitely not making the tournament or going to be on the bubble or whatever. Like, there's so much basketball to be played. But in order to win, like, you know, the meat of the ACC schedule, you can't be messing around just because one guy is 7-2 or you know, one lineup what's better on paper than others. Like, get your best five out there most of the time and play around that. And we do know Boeheim will cut down his rotation without much thought of, like, or care about, like, worrying about someone's playing time. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see some move soon. I just hope that they are kind of forward-thinking and he can find a way to do the best out of these guys, because right now it has been consistently an issue.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't to bash Boeheim by any means, but I don't think it's a stretch to say that he's never been an offensive coach. I think this team has not necessarily in recent years looked to address that shortcoming, and most of the time the defense is good enough that it doesn't really matter. Defense is still pretty good this year. Advanced metrics show that, base numbers, raw numbers show that, but like, there's just so much regression. Dolezal won't attack, Frank can't attack, it seems, so you basically are left with Battle. Brissett is taking too many shots from outside. Elijah Hughes is largely an option on the wing, though he's been able to draw free throws. And that's really it. Shukwu, as you said, kind of a black hole on offense. Same with Sidibe. Like, those two guys have regressed significantly on both ends. I know, like, a couple weeks ago, Dylan on the site kind of looked at, you know, how all three players that could play at the five were performing on both ends. And, you know, the exchange on the defensive end really wasn't that much. I know that Boeheim kind of scoffed at the idea of Dolezal at the five for a long-term solution, but it might have to be. And I hope that, you know, he at least gives it a shot in maybe some of these lesser games, but there really aren't a lot of lesser games left on the schedule. I mean, ODU was no pushover, but ODU showed like what happens when this team can't play on offense. Like, there's just far too much reliance on Battle. I mean, there's been a lot of conversations about this in the last couple of days. I do think this offense is significantly worse right now than it was last year, just because at least last year we knew, like, you know, Frank wasn't always the most accurate, but he was a quality enough shooter. Battle was going to be, I think Battle's pretty much been what we've asked him to be. And Brissett, like, as you mentioned before, like, is worse than he was last year at the moment. I don't know what happened with his mechanics over the offseason. Even the first couple games of the season, he was pretty good. But he's seemingly abandoned a lot of the things that were so critical to his success as a freshman. So yeah, right now, like, if we're not going to give Carey more minutes, if Buddy Boeheim's not going to be able to rise to the challenge, then it really has to once again fall to like one of just a small handful of players. And I think, you know, SU becomes much, much easier to game plan for when you know that Battle's already the only guy that you definitely have to plan for as an offensive threat, while everybody else is just a question mark.
Yeah, and it's not. We hope that he could be more efficient, and also we could get more from these secondary guys, and Brissett would take a leap forward. And we, you know, kind of thought that we might see Brissett turn into like an NBA type player this season. And I know there's a question right now already of like whether he could even leave based on the start. Obviously, there's still a ton of time left, but right. He just doesn't seem to have added like a ton to his arsenal. It seems like he's mostly the guy that we had last year. So the guy last year was also a freshman who was still like kind of finding his way into the rotation, and for that reason he was a little bit more or a little less willing to take a big shot or like look for himself, which we were hoping that we'd see a more aggressive Brissett this season, but it's turned into like more aggressive but also way less efficient. He's not getting the line as much, I don't think, this season as he was last year, which was a huge asset where he could really kind of bully guys and get them into foul trouble.
He's also a bit less accurate from the free throw line, I believe, when he has gotten in.
That feels right. Let me look.
Yeah, we got 69%, a very not nice percentage in this case versus 78.7.
He was at like 79 last year.
Yeah, that's a huge step back in one of the easiest aspects of the game. Like, this is just it's a ill-timed regression.
He's actually shooting better from the field overall, but the full 10% worse than the line, and it's actually weird. He's taking basically the exact same breakdown of shots. He's taking like actually a slight uptick in total shots. He's taking the exact same amount of threes and making a slightly fewer. It's the free throws that's the biggest issue, and he's averaging the exact same amount of points as he was last year. So, like, raw numbers-wise, it doesn't look a lot worse, but it just feels like you expected him to really take a big step up, and that hasn't happened. And he's also rebounding. He's been less effective rebounding, even though he's, he was kind of a monster there. This year he's been a little more consistent. Again, like, he's young. It's only a sophomore year. It does seem like he is kind of looking for his own number a little bit more, which isn't the worst thing if he starts playing better, but hopefully he lets the game come to him a little bit, because we do need him to be the player he showed last season. But the fact that he's only a sophomore and that we've seen him play well makes me think, like, you know, we can count on him a little bit more. And he was pretty hot in these last four wins before the ODU game. So if he reverts back to, like, the player we saw in Northeastern, even, like, the Cornell game, he had a solid, if not great, game against Ohio State in limited minutes. Like, there were some good signs, but in the losses, he's earlier in the season and this week, like, you kind of saw where the issues are.
Oh, absolutely. I think that, like, I think the boards is really, you know, where this team is most concerning. Not because I think the offense is fine, because it's not, but if you just take a look at the boards, like, BJ Stith is a guard and did whatever the hell he wanted on the glass. I think team after team, no matter, you know, what level they seem to be at talent-wise, are able to just completely, you know, abuse us on the boards. And having guys like Chukwu and Sidibe who are tall only has advantages if they're actually able to collect those rebounds. I think, you know, last year Chukwu was rarely, you know, effective on offense, but he could make a basket if called upon, and was also able to be pretty effective, you know, rebounding. I think, you know, seeing those guys step back, seeing Brissett step back, like, we're losing rebounding battles to teams much, much smaller than us. I mean, once again, we're one of the, if not the tallest team in college basketball, and yet we are woeful collecting missed shots. I don't understand it. I'm not going to understand it. I also think that it's going to wreak some havoc against Buffalo on Tuesday.
Yeah, that is a big spot of the rare game where we have a chance to play an undefeated team at the Dome, a top 15 team at the Dome, and one that is from the MAC conference and not a Power 5 league. But Buffalo's legit. I mean, I think we all saw that Buffalo, the win over West Virginia earlier in the year. CJ Massenburg is a very, very good player. They have four double-digit scorers. They're not a great shooting team, but they have a couple guys who knock them down, Massenburg especially, who hits a lot of big shots. He's kind of their tightest battle, not to make, like, a very, like, lazy comparison, but he's a senior guard, just hits, like, a ton of just huge clutch shots. They are a strong scoring team. They shoot pretty well from the field, so this is a pretty scary bunch.
Yeah, I mean, they play at pace, so there's the potential that, you know, they can't do exactly what Old Dominion did, if only because Old Dominion chose to play the same sort of grind-it-out style that we did. But yeah, I mean, Massenburg is one of the best gunners in the entire, in, like, in all of college basketball, and he's rightfully made a name for himself, you know, plus putting up 17-7 a game. Like, he's somebody who SU's going to be able, who's going to have to get a body on, and if they choose to focus on him a little bit more and let the other guys score, the problem is here. It's not like some of the other teams we faced, like between Nick Perkins, Jeremy Harris, Javon Graves. Like, these are all guys, I mean, even Devonta Jordan, like, all these guys can score, and they're averaging 85 points a game. Like, SU can't necessarily win a track meet, and Orange fans should be very, very concerned about this game, because not only would it mean we're 7-4 and off to, you know, a pretty terrible start, but would also really prevent us from being able to do much more in non-conference play that helps us out. We'd really have to rely pretty heavily on ACC play this time around if we want to make the tournament again. Now, granted, if Frank Howard, you know, rights the ship and he's healthy, and if this offense starts looking like even, you know, some semblance of what we thought it could, then SU will probably be fine. They'll still be able to win 10 or 11 games in the ACC and make the tournament. But, like, if we're once again hanging around the bubble, the resume takes a huge hit if you lose to Buffalo too.
Yeah, it's I don't think, even with Buffalo being in the top 15, like, it'll still look pretty bad if we lose to Buffalo at home. And that's unfortunate. That's unfortunate for the Bulls. It's probably unfair to them, to be honest. But people are not going to say, like, oh, they're, you know, number 14 Buffalo. They could be a 5 seed in the tournament with how they've played so far. People are going to say, oh, you just lost to Buffalo out of the MAC, the team that tried to copy the New York State's team or whatever thing a couple of years ago. Like, it's not – it's actually worse that they're local, I think, if we lose. And I don't think we're going to do that much credit if we win, no, to be very frank.
I think it's going to be a lot of that. I think it's also going to be just the fact that it's 2 straight losses at home. I know I mentioned this on the blog today. I think, like, the other issue you have to think through is that this pretty much negates – you know, the Ohio State win in a lot of ways, because the Ohio State win seemed to be a bit of a gauge on, okay, this is what this team is when Frank's in, and then we can ignore what happened in MSG. After the ODU loss and after a potential loss to Buffalo, can't really say that anymore. And now those losses have to count for something. So I definitely think we're in significantly worse shape now, first because of the loss to the Monarchs, and if we lose to the Bulls, we'll be in even obviously more terrible shape, not just because of the loss, because I don't think, not to slight Buffalo, if we lose to Buffalo, I don't think these losses just count as one anymore. They start kind of multiplying onto themselves, and that's where, you know, SU gets in some real trouble again without being able to right the ship.
I haven't looked. Do we know where they are in the vaulted net rating? Like, how much advanced credit is Buffalo getting so far?
I am looking up the net rating as we speak, and Buffalo is 12th.
Okay. Yeah, so even if, like, we don't get, like, you know, dumb people credit for winning that game, if it happens, obviously, and that's a very big if, it could still be a really nice resume boost.
We have two top 25 wins.
Yeah, Buffalo's legit. Like, I don't want to disparage Buffalo at all. They're very legit. I just realized they played at St. Bonnie's, who I think we are also kind of worried about that game in a couple weeks. They blew Bonnie's out at home.
And Bonnie's are taking a pretty big step back this year. But
they're still scary enough.
They are.
Play this hard.
I mean, Buffalo beating San Francisco is pretty legit. USF's actually pretty good this year. Top 25 net rating USF.
Are they? I didn't realize they were any good. I know they're occasionally decent, but I feel like we haven't heard them in a national conversation in a while. And then obviously they beat West Virginia at West Virginia and looked really, really good doing it. So Buffalo's good. You need to win this game, I think. I'm not going to say that they can't win the tournament if they lose this game, but I think it would go a long way towards calming people down. Cause like, and deservedly so, like, people were very depressed after this ODU loss, and I was kind of with them. I don't think it means the season's over by any means, but it's hard to, like, look on the bright side after that, because it was, like, just close enough to those first two losses that, like, it kind of made it seem like all the work that's been done since has kind of gone to the wayside, right, which is not great.
Agreed. And, I mean, you look at Buffalo, too. Like, if you beat them, I mean, whether you beat them or not, there's a real chance for this Bulls team to potentially, you know, go unbeaten. I know it sounds ridiculous. I know MAC play always gets a little weird. But other than us, they go at Marquette. So they got two more road games at Canisius, and then they start MAC play at Eastern Michigan. There's not a MAC team that can really match them talent-wise. If they beat us, yeah, they're a potential, like, unbeaten or close team, and one that could potentially go, you know, top four, top five seeds. Even if they lose to us, that they could still very well win out, and that would definitely help SU. So, we'll see. I hope the Orange win. I hope this conversation gets to everybody's earbuds with all of this still on the table.
Yeah, it would be a nice way to get into the holiday season. But, you know, at least we're a football school now.
We are a football school. And on that note, we're going to talk...
That is a transition.
That is a perfect segue. We're going to talk a little bit about signing day before we talk Camping World Bowl in the second half of the episode. Signing day should be, I'm gonna say, predictable once again. SU doesn't really have a lot of, like, late flips in recent years. They've had a few late flips away, a few late additions. I know for the most part, like, most on the content end, most of the guys that we're writing up profiles for are going to end up on the team. The likelihood of adding other guys has increased recently, but I still think this was a smaller class than it was supposed to be, but it's one that, you know, has a couple really big names. You know, Michael Jones, is the top 300 to 400 guy, depending on who you ask. Lee Pogba's another top 400 or so guy. Cornelius Nunn's a top 500-ish guy. It's a very defensive-heavy class. It's probably not going to finish as well-ranked as last year's, and that's fine. I think that people have to view all these things with some bit of perspective. I think that it is understandable at the same time, though, that people are wondering why SU wasn't able to roll a 9-3 season into what could have been like maybe a top 40, top 45 class if a couple other bigger names could have joined this group.
Yeah, this early signing day is kind of like reduced a lot of the drama in recruiting overall. I don't think SU's going to have a super dramatic day. And yeah, the rankings, like, it's going to be a small class, it seems like. Right now it's a small class at 16 people. That's where most of the... I think that's why it's ranked where it is, at like 58 on 24/7. The rankings are very much based on... I mean, they're obviously the type of player you get, but also the like number of players you get. So bigger classes always do well. This is a very high-quality class compared to what SU is used to getting. We have, obviously, Michael... do we know if it's Mikkel or Michael?
I'm going to go with Michael.
Or just Michael. Is like a composite four-star. Pogba and Nunn are both four-stars elsewhere besides 24/7. If you just added in, like, four or five more median players to this class, it would be ranked in the 40s pretty solidly. It's just, like, right now, I don't think we have a lot of spots available, so this class is never going to be that big. It also kind of seems like we're holding off for a couple guys, and we'll probably fill out the rest of the group after this early signing day with, you know, people who we get involved with later, or like late blooming recruits, maybe save a couple JUCO spots. So definitely not worth freaking out about the rankings yet, if at all, ever, honestly. It's just not worth freaking out about.
Yeah, I mean, SU's had plenty of success with, you know, top 50 to 60 or 60 to 70 classes. You know, even Greg Robinson's terrible recruiting classes had a couple future NFL players in it. You look at Kansas State for years, was able to succeed without top-level talent at all. I know Wisconsin's done the same thing. Like, the list goes on. Recruiting rankings matter to some extent. I think they're very indicative of who's going to be competing for national championships. But when you're Syracuse or most of the country, and you're not competing for national championships, as long as you finish in that top 50 to 60 range as a Power 5 school, if you're getting the guys that you need and you want, you're probably fine. This group is interesting in a few ways, I think, you know, without going to every single player. You have, you know, several guys from Canada. We've made some real inroads in North Carolina, some real inroads potentially in South Carolina, depending on who we're able to add. Obviously, the usual Florida contingent in D.C., Florida and D.C. have become real, real bankable, you know, options for us with this staff. I think, you know, each class has brought in one to two guys from D.C., you know, four to five guys at minimum from Florida. Credit to Nick Monroe in particular for being able to really get those that South Florida pipeline going. And the success of those guys, which should continue, just helps get more I know it's not the easiest sell to get somebody from, you know, states like Texas or Florida or California to come to a place like Syracuse, but the staff's been able to do it. You know, speaking of Texas, Dorian Hewitt's another guy from Texas adding to the pipeline there. I think what stands out to me most notably, looking at this class too, is just you see the quality of offers. I mean, the Canada kids don't really get the same amount of looks as some of the top tier U.S. guys. But
no, they're not even close. Yeah. It's like shocking that any of them are three stars, to be honest.
Well, 24/7 updated them, and I think a lot of it's just like at this point, SU is a caliber where like if they're offering some guy, chances are he's good enough. And you look at like Jeff Canton in particular, fourth best player according to 24/7 that we have coming in. Matthew Bergeron's fifth. But you look at the quality of these offers down the list, like. This is probably our best in, I mean, since I can even remember, if you look at all these kids, like pretty much everybody's holding at least a couple like big name, like Jones, Clemson, Georgia, Auburn, NC State, West Virginia. Pogba's was a West Virginia flip, in Florida State, Maryland, Tennessee, and Duke. Cornelius Nunn had offers from Bama, Miami, Auburn. List goes on here where like these are all pretty sizable offers down the line, and it's great to see. You know, these names improve, obviously, like that was probably our biggest critique of the Schaefer era, among other things. But I think the biggest one of all was just kind of how MAC level talent was trying to be passed off as Power 5, caliber players, and that's no knock on all those kids. Some of them did really work out very well for us, but plenty didn't, and were unable to compete at the ACC level, and a lot of that's why. I think, you know, stars are important to some extent, but more important, I think, is this caliber of offers. And if you see a kid with three stars, say like Courtney Jackson is like a two-star rating from Rivals for some reason, but you look at the offers he has, you know, Kentucky, West Virginia, Cincinnati, Boston College, Baylor, a bunch of others, like, or even Amon Greenwood from DC, you know, he's got Mizzou, Michigan, BC, Pitt, UNC, like guys like that. If you're a three-star, chances are with those types of offers, you're probably on the higher end of that. And obviously, you know, some really great schools with some really great resources far beyond even what we have, see enough in you to offer you.
Yeah. A really good example of that is Dylan Gabriel. He is a quarterback out of Hawaii who, you know, there's a pretty good track record of quarterbacks out of Hawaii in recent years with Marcus Mariota, Tua Tagovailoa, Mackenzie Milton at UCF. He is a two-star recruit because he's from Hawaii, and they don't evaluate it super hard. I mean, it's not that easy to evaluate it unless you're doing the camp circuit, which is when Tua blew up, is when he started doing the, he, you know, fly to California to do the camps for the sites there.
Yeah.
But he's down to USC, Georgia, and UCF. Like, if you're down to those three schools, you are not a two-star player. Sorry, like, unless you're like a preferred walk-on or something. So while I do think the star rating system has gotten better over years, and I do think, like, if you extrapolate it out, like, for a long period of time, it does work out, especially on the higher end.
Yeah. That's where it's most accurate, the high end.
Yeah. Yeah, and, like, Bud Elliott updates his piece every year where basically, like, I think it's if you don't have, what, half of your roster being comprised of four and five stars, I don't think any team has ever won a national championship in the star rating era without half of the roster being blue chippers, essentially.
Correct.
And that's, like, you know, there's a lot of evidence behind it. But when you're talking about where Syracuse is, which is, like, the difference between like the Stott Schaefer years and fighting out for 9-10 wins occasionally and playing for decent bowl games, there's a lot of like fungible stuff in there. So right now, according to 24/7, if you go down like on like the average recruit ranking, which is like per player, like we're right around like the low 40s to mid to 50 range, and we're in the same area as schools like a UCF, which recruits at like a low Power 5 level, Arizona, slightly below BC, above Texas Tech, West Virginia, like our peer schools, basically Wake Forest, which is recruiting well this year, Oklahoma State. That's a nice jump up for where we had been under Schaefer and honestly, like Marone, who didn't really recruit. I mean, the rankings were never kind to Marone's recruits. They were actually really kind to G-Rob's, if anything. But like, that's generally the peer group we're going to be in, and then you hope to kind of like build yourself up from there.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like, we're never going to see SU be like a top 30 recruiting class like school. That's just not what we are, but like, that's fine. The volume of three-star recruits is pretty vast. You're going to see a huge, like realistically, there's probably like six tiers or more realistically, I guess the Power 5 level, there are five tiers, but it's more like five-star, four-star, like high three, low three, and two. And really, if you're beyond that, like, you're probably not getting those offers.
Yeah. It's just not, like, anything to super worried about. Just, like, once you're, like, three-star players can be, like, so hit or, I mean, even two-stars, like, can be so hit or miss versus, like, four and five-stars, I think there are busts, and we've had them in, like, probably a higher percentage than most. But, like, generally, you get a pretty good player most of the time versus the threes where you're kind of in the margin. So it's all, it becomes way more important to identify, for your coaches to be able to identify like the actual, you know, diamonds in the rough there, and recruiting less places that get less attention, like the Northeast, becomes it's a challenge, and it's something that Syracuse has to do well. So overall, I think it'll be a positive day to like the bulk of this class locked down and not able to be poached, which is always good for us. On the player side, you can make the argument it's not great for them, but it is a system that we have. So yeah, I think it'll be a mostly positive day for Syracuse. I would be surprised if there are any major surprises. But I know there are a couple of guys that we're like kind of involved in down the stretch here. Although I don't know if there's anyone that's like super gonna like jump off the page for anyone. But there, you know, there could be one or two.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of weeks ago we fell off the radar for Darius Robinson. Today, Adisa Isaac committed to Penn State. those were the two bigs that we're still really in on. There's a couple left out there. I know Cooper Dawson and Michael Dukes, both from Charleston. There's potential that if we get one, we get both.
Yeah, I think there's a decent shot of those guys. I think Octavius Brothers, Dylan wrote about or put with the article today.
What's it called, Brendan?
Yes. I think he was also on that list, and I think we're right in the range for. So definitely some more, you know, nice players from areas that we want to do well in that we could see by then. And then there's still plenty of time before February, and that's where you get guys who their stocks are starting to rise. And, I mean, you see all the time, Syracuse isn't in – I mean, in any team gets involved in January for a kid and ends up landing him a couple weeks later because they just kind of are able to really focus fire. So this class will not be a finished product by any means on the 19th, but I will be interested to see how many of you guys we plan to take overall, because I think, you know, a lot of it depends on NFL decisions, although I don't know there wouldn't have any surprises in that regard this year. We'll see.
Alton Robinson would probably be the lone, like, surprise, if anyone. Yeah,
if anyone. It just, like, it actually helps that most of our players or good players are either seniors or, like, freshmen and sophomores. We actually have, like, a weird our roster balance is interesting. Our junior class, like, there's talent there, but it's not like our superstars. It's like all like super young guys or like the old guys who have stuck around. Yeah, so I don't really know exactly how big a class we're gonna end up taking, but I think it'll probably be on like the low 20s in the end of the day, and then, you know, spots open up after, and there's always like, I feel like every year there's a couple like April surprises too.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've had those for the last few years. I think right now, like, we have 16 who are definitely in. Juwar Jordan makes 17. Some might recall that he was running back from Arizona who signed last year. He had some nice offers from Big 12 country, Arizona, but unfortunately, some qualifying issues. He did qualify, so he's actually in the fold and will be headed on campus. So he's not signing necessarily, but is an addition here that already gets us up to 17. If we can add Dawson and Dukes, that gets us to 19. We probably won't have more than 20 to 21 spots available. Like you said, there's always some surprises here and there. I'm curious to see what happens. Not to speculate anything too much, but, you know, guys like Devin Butler, some of the older guys around the roster who may have been passed up by younger options. Those are always players who might look elsewhere, but don't necessarily have to either. Babers is willing to play the best players, whoever they may be, whoever recruited them, whenever they got there. So, We'll see what happens there, but this roster is far from done shuffling. We already have one JUCO in this class in Darius Tisdale, who was added about a week ago, but likely we see one to two more added probably along the defensive line, if I had to guess, based on how much kind of trouble we've had, you know, getting a ton of guys at that position over the years.
Yeah, it's and that's also a position that's usually pretty ripe with JUCO talent mm-hmm. compared to others. So if you have to bring in JUCO guys, I think it's not the worst place to have to do it. And we've done a pretty nice job of identifying them. This is our best D-line in a long time, which is good. So if we do have to replace Alton, hopefully we can, the other younger guys have developed pretty well, but we can find some people to plug in.
Agreed. All right, before we get to halftime, quick. One programming note, Tulane beat UL Lafayette. I will not call you Louisiana. 41-24 in the Cure Bowl, the same site that we'll be playing the Camping World Bowl. So that's pretty awesome. Go Green Wave.
Yes, for all of the fellow Syracuse Tulane acolytes that have been camping out in Tampa for a couple weeks, congratulations to you on your first win of many there down there. And hopefully you're not rooting for Penn State versus Kentucky, although I don't really know who to root for in that.
Kentucky, because I don't care about Kentucky football. I only hate Kentucky basketball.
Yeah, that feels right.
I make weird rules about college sports where there's plenty of schools that I hate the football team and have no problem with the basketball team, and vice versa.
And to be fair, Josh Allen and Benny Snell are both really, really fun.
I would very much agree with that. So, halftime, Dan, what have you been drinking of late?
It wasn't a super busy beer week for me. I did have a couple of new things. I thought I had had it before, but I guess I never did. The Bel Air Sour from Brooklyn, which is quite good, like you're pretty, you know, average good sour. And it's from Brooklyn. Brooklyn, I think, is a pretty consistent producer of beer at this point. Like, most of what they do is rock solid, and you're not going to go wrong. And then I also had the Calling Double IPA from Boulevard, which was very, very nice as well. Boulevard has some of my favorite beers. This one was good. I don't think it quite stacks up to like some of their other classics, Tank 9 specific, or Tank 7 rather, Farmhouse specifically, but it was quite good. So I appreciate that.
Fair enough. From me, just a few. I had from Monkish, Life is Foggier, an IPA from them, New England style, obviously. Spocket, another one of those. I grabbed 4-pack of that, so I mentioned that one last week as well. Also hit up a new spot, Gamecraft Brewing, down in Laguna Hills in Orange County. And they're like gaming-themed, but great beers. Had their 1v1 Simcoe Smash IPA. It was 5.5%. So, like, super sessionable and just, like, really enjoyable. Also had their GG Easy. It was another IPA from them. Then I've just been cruising through some Firestone Lager in the fridge. So, some drinking, not a ton. The family will be in town for the holidays, so I'll probably have more to report back, as will you, I'm sure, when we return from the holiday break.
That is a fair bet.
Indeed. Also, while we're here, Q-Sticks for Kids is still going on. It had not launched yet when we last recorded, even though the episode appeared afterward. We did surpass our mark already of $14,444. We're cruising towards, hopefully, what ends up being at least $20,000. We are donating to a couple different organizations, in particular, Sports for the Kids, a Central Florida organization that that helps underprivileged kids have access to sports. It's a pretty cool charity. Unfortunately, they've had their offices robbed and vandalized a couple times this year. So would be great to kind of give them some relief and a cool opportunity to have these kids be able to go to Camp World Bowl to see Syracuse hopefully beat West Virginia. So if you haven't donated yet, or if you want to tell your friends to donate, you can check out the link right at the top of the page on noonsmagician.com and tell them to share with everyone, and let's get some kids to this game. I know it's great that SU's actually donated t-shirts this time, so we'll be able to send more kids than we initially planned for less money, because we don't have to factor in the cost of t-shirts.
Yeah, that was a really nice move by them, and it's awesome for them to kind of endorse this, not, you know, directly, I mean, they're not directly sponsoring it, but they're endorsing it pretty fully from their end. So very cool for them to come together with the site, despite, you know, obviously we're critical when we need to be and we supportive when we need to be. But this is something that everyone in the Syracuse family, the occasionally dysfunctional family at that, can all come together and help here. And it was amazing that we kind of blew it out, I think, on what, Friday or Saturday?
We had a $3,000 donation on Friday. That got us over the mark,
which is crazy. Like, that was incredible when I saw that, and like, you know, obviously I didn't think we would hit like the 44,000 mark that we did the first time. The first time had like its really special energy behind it, but the fact that we were able to still like break through a pretty sizable, like, that's a lot of money. We're over 15,000 right now. Really awesome, and just says so much about this fan base, what it can do when it really gets its energy behind an awesome cause like this. So really proud of everyone involved, and you and Andy have done an awesome job with getting this tradition like this. I think really kind of cements it into becoming like a tradition that we can be proud of as a fan base.
Agreed. And a shout out to Paul Dottle, the donor who put in $3,000 on Friday. I mean, we'd still be, without him, we'd be doing very well, but we'd still be trying to get to the mark. Again, he put us over the top. That's awesome. But again, just because we made it doesn't mean the work here is done. We're working with the charities and SU to finish out these donations very soon. But moving on to the actual Camping World Bowl, which the children will be watching. As we all know, Will Grier not playing. That automatically lowers the odds for West Virginia, but people don't seem to be all that low on Jack Allison. I think that the initial line of around 7, 7.5 was a bit high, especially on a neutral field. I think that the fact that West Virginia is kind of still favored is puzzling. But you look down the injury report for Syracuse, still haven't seen Trill Williams at practice, still haven't seen Ravian Pierce at practice. A couple other names. I think Devin Clark is on that list, too, of guys we haven't seen a ton of in practices so far. I have some good faith that they'll be ready to go. I think Williams obviously being the most critical. Pierce we just didn't really see as much of as we thought, but I do think he's still pretty critical to, you know, pass blocking in particular. And I do hope that all these guys were able to get on the field for a bowl game this year.
Yeah, it'd be kind of a shame. Obviously, like, Trill will be here for a while. He's a true freshman, but you want to see him in there. And just you want to have, like, a full complement of players, even if West Virginia is significantly shorthanded with Will Dreher out, which I think is something that we all kind of, like, thought was a pretty good chance of happening, which made the initial betting line of 7.5. I know they can't, like, fully take into account him being out without him actually announcing it, but, like, I put in a quick bet on Syracuse when it came out that high on a line, just as I thought, like, there was at least, like, a 25 to 30% chance of Will Dreher not playing. And then once their left tackle decided not to play, that pretty much cemented it, because, like, you don't want to, like, the Syracuse pass rush is really good. You do. If you're Will Dreher, I totally get the decision, especially, like, without the guy defending your blind side versus a very motivated Syracuse team with a good pass rush. Like, that is not something I want to be involved with. So, yeah, I think I get why the line isn't, like, totally flipped, like, all the way, but I am a little bit surprised that West Virginia is still even, what, like, a 1.5-point favorite. Like, I would be, like, really, I feel very good about Syracuse in this game, to be honest. Like, I think we have the clear motivation edge, which is huge in these bowl games. I think we'll have, like, closer to a full roster in terms of, like, our sub players. I don't know. We haven't heard from David Sills yet, right, from West Virginia side?
We haven't, but I feel like if we haven't heard from him at this point, he's probably playing.
Yeah, it seems like he'll probably play. And he still has, I think this is last year, I think he still has, like, you know, he could really improve his stock a bit, because he's, you know, kind of a tweener, possession receiver guy. So less, like, less of stuff to jump off the paper at you, aside from his, like, really, really gaudy stats. But I can see why he would want to play to really help himself out. But either way, like, I feel pretty good about Syracuse in this matchup. Just, like, the bowl games are such weird things, because there's, like, a 3 to 4 week gap between them and the last game. There are guys who now sit out for good, very good reasons a lot of the time. There are unexpected injuries. We have, like, the whole weird thing where we could actually see Abdul Adams play, and a couple other guys, I think, who are now eligible.
And Tristan Jackson.
Tristan Jackson. I don't know how much they will, because it's kind of weird to, like, go from not playing all year to them, like, becoming a huge part of the game plan. But I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a couple carries if Babers thinks he can win the game and help out. It's a very strange wrinkle. I hadn't thought of at all, but it makes sense if the semester's over. Like, they've kind of served their year off. But overall, like, it's hard to, like, just, like, look at the two teams, how they did over the year, and, like, know the whole picture in terms of what the bowl game will look like. But I do think all of those, like, outside factors do seem to favor Syracuse here.
Yeah, I completely agree. And also, if you look at just, like, the stats for West Virginia, like, there are a lot of indicators. Not, like, there's no way that Syracuse loses this game, but there are a lot of indicators that say that SU's in pretty good shape. I mean, the running game, good, not great. They average 4.6 yards a carry. That's fine. But, you know, only 1,785 yards on the ground. They did have 21 touchdowns. They did a much better job of taking advantage of, you know, the red zone than we did, like most teams did, to be honest, based on just how SU's been in the red zone of late. But no real, like, you know, lethal back. I mean, Kennedy McCoy's good. He averages 5.7 a carry. Like, in general, like, these top backs are good, but none of them are necessarily game breakers. SU is really, defensively, only suffered when... you know, a team has had, you know, a couple really, really good running backs, or at least one, you know, all league running back, the way Clemson did with, you know, Etienne. I think you look at Notre Dame maybe as a blueprint for how a team could beat us differently. But again, that still required Ian Book out there, and Book obviously being a very good quarterback. Jack Allison might be a decent quarterback, but he's not going to be at the level of Book. He's definitely not the level of Greer either. So despite the fact that Gary Jennings and David Sills and Marcus Sims are all playing for West Virginia, it's going to be a question of whether Allison can get the ball to those guys when the SU pass rush is going to really be bearing down. Like, SU was happy to force teams to beat us through the air. Where we got into trouble was team beating us on the ground. So if West Virginia gets down early and is forced to throw, like, that's where Syracuse's secondary has thrived, when they have, you know, teams taking risks and opportunities to potentially flip the field. I do really like our chances here, and I think that, you know, any SU fan has every right to be at least a little confident of what the Orange can do. I know West Virginia didn't have a great, oddly, I feel like in an air raid type league and you're playing an air raid type offense, that you're going to have more opportunities. But, you know, 23 sacks, they've allowed 24. So, like, considering how much they throw the ball, I'm actually surprised that they didn't allow more sacks. I'm actually surprised that they didn't tally more sacks themselves based on how much teams in the Big 12 throw the ball. So I'm very curious to see, you know, that matchup in particular is what happens in the trenches. I think if SU can dominate that, I think that should really, you know, seal the game for them even pretty early.
Yeah, it is actually interesting because West Virginia, like, they're definitely, like, more of a spread out air raid team, but they run the ball, like, their passing and running is only 407 attempts to 389, so it's not super far out of whack. And they have, as you said, like, three running backs who have gotten a good amount of carries. None of them have, like, really exploded, but they've all been pretty effective without having, like, a true game breaker. But the question will be, like, I don't think West Virginia is going to, I mean, they could, they have had a lot of time to prepare, but I don't see them shifting their offense all to be like this way more run heavy unit. I think you're gonna try to play your game with Allison in there, right. Especially because so much of this is like getting him now ready to be presumptively the starting quarterback next season. I assume that's the plan. You kind of want to run your stuff. So I'm definitely fine seeing him out there, but I do think the game will be in his hands largely, and that is, like you said, he's not Greer, he's not Ian Book, who had probably the best game of his season against us, and they overall don't have Notre Dame's talent around the quarterback. So this kind of plays pretty well into Syracuse's hands. It doesn't mean that West Virginia doesn't have plenty of talent. They do, but they're not the same threat without Greer. Though, you know, I guess he does have, Allison will have, like, a pretty nice complement of receivers with Sills and Gary Jennings, who I think is really flown under the radar because Sills came in with so much hype and, you know, paid off. He had 15 touchdowns this year. Jennings actually had more yards, a little bit more of a big play threat, while Sills is more of a red zone type guy, and then had 13 touchdowns of his own. So assuming both of those guys are going, that's a pretty nice tandem. But this is a tough spot for Allison. It's going to be his first start. I think it's going to be his first, like, significant action. He only has 10 passes on the year, and I don't think he played at all last year. I assume he took a red shirt as a sophomore. So it's not the easiest spot to come into, considering what Syracuse can bring to the table in terms of a pass rush, as we mentioned before.
Yeah, I mean, that's really just going to be the key. If Allison can get the ball out, then they're looking at something through the passing game. But the tone's going to be set by this run game and what the offensive line can do, and I don't think they're going to be able to do as much without a starting tackle available. Said McCoy's a good back, Petaway's a good back, Letty Brown is, like, all these guys are good. But they don't necessarily look any significantly better than, like, SU's backs. I think, too, when you look at that run-pass split, and this is something that I've, you know, previously pointed out a lot in the play-calling breakdowns, 48 of those rushes on the record were Greer, either taken off, which he did here and there, or sacks. So, like, keep that in mind, too. I think
that's a good point.
Yeah, you do end up with a few more passes. I mean, not to any significant amount. It still probably ends up being a 55 to 56 to 45, 44, like, split percentage-wise, but just something to keep in mind. In general, I do just think that SU, being so turnover-minded, being so pressure-heavy, is going to be able to beat this team. And like you said, I think that motivation factor is so big. Usually the teams with something to prove and the teams that are excited to be where they are and want to finish the season strong, like, those are the ones that are really able to keep dedicated in practice. Coaching staffs obviously play a part here too. I think that Syracuse's coaching staff is probably very, very anxious to be able to close out the season with a 10th win, carry that into, you know, potential momentum for next season recruiting wise, what will be a potential top 25 spot. You know, on the line in the off season, it's going to be a lot of hype coming with this team into next spring, and I think a loss isn't going to derail that, but a 10th win is absolutely going to put an exclamation point on all that.
10th win, and I think we almost definitely, we probably have a really nice chance to make a big impression with some recruits we might not have been involved with earlier. Like, I don't know if it's going to overhaul our 2019 recruiting class, but it could really help with 2020, and maybe there's like a guy that we wouldn't have talked to if we only had 7 or 8 wins, who is now more open to us. Plus, obviously, Dino's extension, which obviously helps in recruiting and just helps our fan base not lose its mind any more so than it already will with basketball going the way it has. Plus, I think will almost definitely enter next season ranked relatively high. Like, I would guess we'd easily be in the top 25 for the early 2019 poll, probably, like, in the 20-ish range, which is awesome. And then we have a chance to really build on that early next season. So it just all kind of compounds. And while, like, rankings early in the season don't really mean much, and, like, a lot of this other stuff doesn't mean a lot, you're trying to play the game, and recruiting, it really is kind of the name of it in terms of, like, selling Syracuse as this destination program now that you can accomplish really big things at. And I do think the 10th win, while, like, it doesn't mean that much more than 9 wins, there's something about that double-digit number to, like, casual fans who we want to buy tickets for season ticket sales, for, again, recruits, which is what this all honestly comes down to, donors. Like, it's a big thing. So I think we'll all sign for where SU is right now in terms of, like, being able to win this game against West Virginia. And we've heard from West Virginia fans, they're not all that amped about this matchup, which probably makes me more confident.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think you can usually read a team in many ways by how the fan base seems. And I think, you know, in this case, like, the fan base being a little down on it probably indicates a team that's not exactly excited. I think, you know, you pointed out a lot of great stuff around what this could do for recruiting. I think that, you know, when SU looks at recruits and sees some of the typical, you know, competitors, you know, Pitt, despite the fact that they won the Coastal and the fact that they beat us, still not going to have 10 wins this year. Rutgers, nowhere near 10 wins. BC, repeatedly at 7 wins. You know, playing the other programs that we're recruiting against are not going to be able to have a 10-win season that they can hang on to. The fact that Dino will be able to, you know, tell kids, hey, you know, if 2 out of every 3 years this season, you know, gets us in the Orange Bowl, and, like, you know, this could be the norm for us. I mean, I don't necessarily agree it's going to be the norm, but, you know, you stretch the truth a little bit, obviously, to sell anyone on anything, and not just recruits, but tell them, like, hey, like, if this was next year, and if you're on this team next year, we're going to the Orange Bowl. Like, that's an awesome selling point, and it's definitely something combined with what is definitely a sizable pay raise and extension that sets SU up pretty well.
Yeah, I think it's hard to undersell, like, the positives that would come, and the positives of making this game at all and being a 9-win team at all are already big. Like, it definitely doesn't, like, take away from what we've already accomplished, but you really, like, get to stack up, like, the big tangential victories by getting to number 10 and winning this bowl game on national television on Friday evening. Just really a huge opportunity. So I'm very pumped that we're in this spot at all. And I'm super excited for the game. The most excited I've been for a Syracuse football game in a while, and that's saying something considering, like, this year was pretty exciting start to finish, which is not something we always get to say with this team.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you. I'm nervous. I'm excited. I feel like for us, bowl games have usually meant something of late because we've had so few of them. Maybe this feeling goes away, but for me, just great to be able to be, you know, this jacked up about December football for Syracuse and to potentially, you know, extrapolate that feeling out well beyond this season.
It'll be a fun off season if we are set to enter as, like, a, you know, preseason top 25 program with just so much potential, a stacked roster of young players, a coaching staff that's probably secured, at least as secured as we can think. Obviously, there was that report that from, I think, a day or two ago that Ohio State had Dino on their very short list if they weren't going with Ryan Day. That report's from the Toledo Blade, I believe, so it's on the ground down there. That's both a little jarring, but also, like, if that's caliber, I mean, Ohio State's one of those jobs where if he was to leave for it, you just, like, give him a high five on the way out and said, you know, thanks for coming. Like,
we were good enough to get Ohio State its next coach.
Yeah, like, that's one of the few jobs that will probably, like, I know we haven't heard the contract details yet. We'll probably find those out at some point, I would guess. But if that's the type of job that he's going to get looked at for, like, you hope that his buyout number is quite nice. and then you're like, you know what, you can't, if you're going to lose your dice to the NFL, basically any NFL job, which we saw with Marone, or there's, like, maybe 10 college jobs that are just like, okay. And if they have to, like, really outbid us, so be it. Hopefully you use that money and you get to pay the next coach more and you get to show that you're, like, a really attractive Power 5 job now. And that's, you know, a problem that any school like in our you know range or that aspires to be like better than we've been has to deal with. So, you know, if the USC job opens or something, I know we've talked about that one a lot. If they open and they look at Dino, same thing. Like they're a big name, and even them, like I don't think it's a guarantee that he would jump ship. He probably would, but USC has enough issues that it's not a guarantee. But there are just so few of those schools that it's like, and they don't open that often. And when they do open, they have such a different way of going about looking at their next coach. It's not always just like a slam dunk who, you know, go hire the one of the hot, like, smaller P5 names. Like, that's often where they go, but it's not all the time. That it's just like, it's hard to worry about it.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you there. I think the list, without getting into this full conversation, I think the list is probably Texas, Oklahoma, LSU, maybe, Alabama, Florida, potentially Georgia,
Florida State.
Yeah, Florida State, Ohio State,
Auburn,
Michigan.
We'll probably do it because they pay enough.
Yeah, Auburn's maybe. SC.
Auburn's one that actually scares me because they are so close to firing Malzahn.
Right. But I think that fan base and the boosters are so unrealistic about expectations.
They're 100%.
Yeah, I think
that doesn't mean that they won't offer someone $6 million next year.
Oh, 100%. But I think Dino might be wise to it. So we'll see there. SC, I mentioned.
There's like 10 to 15, and some of them are stretches.
Yeah, and that's really the list.
Like, with Auburn, like, and not just Auburn, even with USC, like, a lot of those jobs have their warts, like, on full display, too.
Right.
So, like, Dino, and who knows what Dino's mindset is if he was to get an offer like this, and we really couldn't blame him if he was to take it. But a guy like Dino, he's, what, 58? It probably has one more stop, like one more big shot if he wants to take it at like a huge job. And, you know, maybe he's happy, you know, just playing, being at Syracuse at like 70. I think we would be happy with that as of this point. But if he has one more big shot, like he wants to make sure he takes the right one. And if you're looking at like Gus Malzahn didn't run out of town a year after winning the SEC West, or almost didn't run out of town a year after winning the SEC West because they don't beat Alabama more than 33% of the time. Like, maybe that's not the job you want to go make your one big last stop. Like, it's that's just one example. So, like, it's not obvious that he goes and takes it because we really don't know where his mind is on things, since he will never actually reveal that.
I would very much agree. Dan, anything else before we leave?
No, I think we covered everything. Hopefully basketball rebounds. I mean, we're not going to be recording for a while, so hopefully everything is chipper and on the up and up. I think we'll probably have what, like, two or three basketball games, and then obviously the bowl game between the Nets before the Nets recording.
We will.
Cool.
All right. On that note, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you everybody for listening to Troy Noon's and Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk. Please be sure to donate to Q's Ticks for Kids if you haven't already, and go Orange.
Go Orange.